Hey, Bill Nye, the science guy here.
This is Salman Rushdie.
Hi, this is Julia Sweeney.
I'm Neil deGrasse Tyson.
This is Theo Wilson.
Hi, this is Dar Williams.
I'm Mr. Deity, and you're listening to The Humanist Hour. I command you to listen now, or I will smite you.
Yes, I am a sound scientist. Came to evaluate the evidence on a closed case, highly classified, confidential, in a race against the clock.
Hi, this is Todd.
And I'm Jess. You're listening to The Humanist Hour, the official podcast of the American Humanist Association.
Humanism is the philosophy of striving to be good without belief in the supernatural and deities.
So, Todd, we have sort of a hot topic guest, I suppose you could say, on our show this month.
Yeah, we have Dr. Marty Klein, who we interviewed at the American Humanist Association convention in New Orleans.
So Dr. Klein is here to talk about, well, first of all, Dr. Klein is a licensed family, marriage, and sex therapist. So he's got some clinical expertise behind him. He's also an author, and he gave a talk at our conference about his latest book, which is called America's War on Sex. And he gave a talk saying that basically he sees opportunities in what he's calling America's War on Sex, where humanism can do a few things. We can become active with public policy around sex education and reproductive health and things of that nature. We can shape like the sort of social construct around sexuality and healthy sex, and we can grow as a movement.
Exactly. Yeah, he was an interesting person to talk to because at the time, some of these various conversations, the movement around the need for anti-harassment policies were just, things were heating up at that point when we talked to him in early June. And I at least at that point in time, really wasn't sure where I stood on some of these issues and was trying to learn more. And I found our interview with Marty to be something that was of educational value to me, where I got to ask some questions and get some good input. As a matter of fact, I spent a fair bit of the time at that conference, not just talking to Marty, but talking to a lot of different people and getting inputs from men and women and of various stripes and various positions on it. And so this interview with Marty was kind of one piece that helped me form my opinions overall. And I agree with some of what he says. I don't necessarily agree fully with every single piece, but it was definitely an interesting perspective of somebody who hasn't been that active in the movement so far.
Sure. Yeah, Marty is kind of new to at least the scene of humanist and free thought conferences. I mean, he's been contributing work to a lot of, like, for example, to the Humanist Network News for quite some time. So mm-hmm. He's not new to the movement, but he's new to participating in the movement.
Well, he was new to me.
Yeah.
I hadn't met him yet.
Sure.
So, speaking of controversial, actually, I've been finding myself in lots of controversial things recently. Have you seen any of these posts I've been doing on The Blaze?
No.
Yeah, so The Blaze is Glenn Beck's media outlet, and they came to the Reason rally and were asking about people, and they were asking if there was any conservative atheists or humanists, and Brother Richard sent them my way. And they ended up doing a profile on me, and then that went well. And they, which I was surprised, actually, I'll admit, I thought they were going to rip me a new one, but they were actually pretty fair. And I suggested to him that we do an Ask an Atheist column to educate some of the ridiculously ignorant commenters on the profile they did. And so we've done three of them so far, and boy, oh boy, has that ruffled some feathers.
Oh, yeah?
Oh, yeah. Some people didn't like what I had to say about the fact that we don't know a whole lot about what really happened with Jesus's life and the whole empty tomb and all that stuff. And yeah, they didn't really like me pointing out the pro-slavery and pro-genocide quotes in the Bible. Yeah.
That's funny. Like, they're there. Pointing them out or not, they're still there.
My favorite on some of these were, two of my favorites were, one, the responses about some of those Bible quotes on slavery, genocide, and tearing women apart and killing the children, saying things like, well, you know, this is just ridiculous. I mean, obviously this stuff looks bad unless you, but if you look at it in context, it all makes sense. It's like context, because, you know, there's a lot of context where slavery and genocide is perfectly justified, clearly.
Right.
And the other one is, somebody keeps one of the commenters continuously advocates that I am not really an atheist. I'm really a homosexual posing as an atheist to try to absolve myself of the guilt I feel as a Christian about my sinful lifestyle.
What?
I'm sorry, I had to laugh. It's like, exactly. What? How'd you get to that one?
Yeah.
Maybe I need some more introspection.
Well, we did learn that atheists don't have more sex, but they feel a lot less guilt after they do have sex.
That this is true. This is true. We have learned that.
Mm-hmm. Oh, goodness gracious.
So if you want some entertainment, just search my name in The Blaze. And I warn you, try to look at the comments with some humor, because otherwise they'll just piss you off or baffle you at how ignorant people can be.
All right, Toddle, why don't you go ahead and introduce this month's guest?
So this is Marty Klein, who we gave a brief introduction to earlier. He is a American sex therapist, author, and educator. Some of his works include America's War on Sex, The Attack on Law, Lust, and Liberty, Beyond Orgasm, Dare to Be Honest About the Sex You Really Want, Sexual Intelligence, Politics, Culture, and Media. Do you notice a trend here?
I do.
Media and Sex, Let Me Count the Ways, Discovering Great Sex Without Intercourse, and several other books. He also blogs at Sexual Intelligence, which is sexualintelligence.wordpress.com.
And here he is, Dr. Marty Klein. Well, listeners, we're here with Dr. Marty Klein, who is a licensed marriage and family therapist, as well as a certified sex therapist. And of course, Dr. Klein, you're an author, and you're here at the AHA conference talking about your latest book, which is America's War on Sex. Can you tell our listeners about that?
Well, I've written 7 books, Jess, and America's War on Sex was first published in 2006 during the height of the George Bush administration. And a few years later, Prager asked me to do an updated edition after the book had won a few awards. So the new updated edition just came out about 6 weeks ago, and it's updated to include the Tea Party and Mr. Santorum and Michelle Bachmann and some of the failures of the Obama administration to do anything differently than the Bush administration around the issues of sexuality.
Now, some people might call what you're referring to as the war on sex the war on women. So can you talk about the difference that you see between the two?
Well, as you know, Jess, I'm a very ardent feminist. So, of course, it's easy to see the ways in which a lot of public policies are hurting women. But most women have sex with men in this country. And so anything that affects women affects men as well. And if you look at the various policies that Americans are forced to struggle with, policies on the state, local, federal level about contraception, about pornography, about censorship of the internet, it's really about sex. When sex education policies are designed to prevent young people from knowing about their bodies, that's not a war on liberals, it's not a war on women, it's not a war on the clitoris, it's a war on sex. And I think it's important for people to understand that because we all are born with a sexuality, and we all have to learn how to negotiate our own sexuality in the world. To that extent, the war on sex is not doing us any favors.
And so what does this war on sex have to do with the humanist movement?
Well, humanism, of course, is the radical idea that people should have choices about how they express themselves, and the radical idea that science and rationality should drive public policy rather than feelings. And there's very few arenas in human life where people have more feelings than in sexuality. So people have feelings about this. Organized religion drives people to have a lot of conflicted feelings about sexuality. And then when the religious right and the sexual disaster industry drives people to a frenzy of anxiety and fear about sexuality, then people clamor for and support public policy around sexual restrictions. So, for example, the religious right is promulgating the idea that sex education makes kids go out and be sexual. And so parents get anxious about that. And parents say, well, we need sex education to teach our kids to not have sex. Here's another example. The religious right is scaring the heck out of American parents about your kids are vulnerable to predators online. They want to snatch your kids out of their homes and drive them to a cornfield in Iowa and do terrible things to them. And then parents, of course, respond to that by clamoring for policies where their kids are going to be safer online. Well, as it happens, according to the Berkman Institute at Harvard University, in a massive report signed off on, by the way, by 49 of the 50 state attorneys general, it's very clear that young people are vulnerable to bullying online much more than any sort of vulnerability to sexual predators. And most of the solicitation that goes on online is between peers, not between adults and children. So the religious right's doing a great job of scaring the hell out of people about sex and then suggesting public policies that respond to that anxiety. In the humanist movement, we need to be talking more about that anxiety, that fear, that anger that the religious right is deliberately driving. It's great marketing that they do. They have a great way of talking about people's feelings. In humanism, we do a great job of talking about science and rationality, which we should, but we also need to learn to talk about feelings because that's where people live.
How much of this war on sex is being driven outside of religion?
I guess it depends on how we define religion, but of course, local city councils, for example, they're responsible for massive levels of problems when it comes to sexuality. Zoning codes that exclude adult businesses from normal commercial areas. When states pass laws saying that sex offenders can't live within 1,000 feet of any human activity. So it's not only religious organizations like the American Family Association or the Family Research Council. It's city councils, state legislatures, obviously the federal government with its policies, with Congress trying to legislate people's access to sexual material either on the internet or in their local adult bookstore. So, and by the way, it's also certain professions. I'm ashamed to tell you that my own profession of psychology is part of the difficulty that people have about sexuality. Most civilians don't realize that you can get a license to practice marriage and family therapy without ever hearing the word vibrator in your training, without ever hearing the word clitoris in your training, without ever hearing the word panties in your training. The training that you get in sexuality in order to be a marriage counselor is primarily about sexual violence. It's primarily about adult child sexual exploitation. There's virtually nothing about healthy sexuality. There's virtually nothing about how to enhance pleasure and satisfaction in individuals or couples. And there's virtually nothing about sexual diversity other than, oh, by the way, some people are gay. So it's, you're right, Todd, it's not just religious organizations. It's some professions, the medical profession has some problems too, as well as governmental units.
Why do you think the religious opponents are so against the concept of healthy sexuality?
You know, the Italians have a wonderful expression, and it sounds better in Italian, which I don't speak. And the expression is, bed is the poor man's opera. And the idea is that sexuality is the place that anyone can go to experience autonomy and that anyone can go and experience and implement their creativity. And there are other things in life where you have to be rich or you have to be young or you have to be fit or you have to be good looking, but not when it comes to sex. Anybody who wants to can experience sexual satisfaction and creativity and self-expression. And that, I think, is one of the main reasons, the other being about conception, but that is one of the main reasons that religion is so anxious about sexuality. It's a place of maximum autonomy for people and where people can discover their own power. And I have lots of patients over the last 31 years who came in with a sexual issue. As we resolve the sexual issue, they acquire emotional skills that serve them in the rest of their lives as well. And they become more assertive, they become more communicative, they become more creative, and they start to think in ways that they hadn't been able to think before. And that, of course, is religion's worst nightmare.
When you take a broad brush to the psychology of this, there are certain commonalities, such as fear. What kind of messages would you recommend humanists bring to those people that could be equally as effective as the messages they get from the religious right?
That's a great question, Todd. And I think the number one message that humanists need to be putting out about sexuality is that sex is not dangerous. Bad sexual decision-making is dangerous. Sexuality is not dangerous. That's the first thing. The second thing is that we have a value system about sexuality. It's not just the religious right that has a value system. We have a value system too. Our value system about sexuality is the same as our value system about everything else. We believe in the value of information. We believe in people taking responsibility for themselves, using that information. We believe in consent in all human relationships, sexual and otherwise. We believe in honesty between people. We believe in the value of communication. And we honestly believe that no matter what people's points of view, no matter what people's agendas, we honestly believe that communication makes things better, and that communication is the glue between people that can help the human race move forward. That's what we believe about everything, and humanists, I think we should be saying, handle sexuality the way we handle everything else, with respect, with a certain amount of humor and joy, and that what we have in mind is not people having sex with their horses out in the street, but rather what we have in mind is empowering people to make whatever choices they want to make, as long as they involve consent and responsibility, of course, that we want to empower people to make whatever choices work for them, rather than telling people that there's one code of behavior that works for every single person on earth, and that that code is special when it comes to that little equipment you got between your legs.
All right.
Marty, how does that translate into public policy?
The way this translates into public policy is the same way that it would translate for humanists and public policy in non-sexual arenas. So the first thing would be, we challenge any public policy that's based on fear rather than fact. And that's a lot of public policy. So before we, for example, criminalize certain kinds of, say, pornography, we would say, well, why would we do that as long as people have the option of not looking at it? Before we zone away strip clubs or swing clubs, we would say, are people forced to consume these activities? No, then let's have them. We would also require that since most sexual activity is a form of expression under the law, we would want the First Amendment to the Constitution to be a big factor in the kinds of policies that we have. So I think that there are a lot of different ways that we can have fact-based public policy rather than fear-based public policy, and that we can have public policy that's based on adults being allowed the privilege of managing their own decisions as long as they're done in a private way. Now, I don't think anybody should be forced to go to a swing club, not even you, Todd. Nobody should be forced to go to a swing club.
Nobody's trying to force me.
But if people want to go to a swing club and they're adults and there's a lock on the door, there's no rational reason that a community should want to prevent that, and there's no First Amendment way that a community could legally prevent that. That's the kind of public policy I think a humanist association would want to promote.
Let's talk openness in relationships and sexuality. You mentioned before it's communication is the key. What is your advice to couples in regards to their communication in the bedroom in terms of, you know, you mentioned creativity, so in terms of desire, in terms of what they want that they may feel uncomfortable that the other person may want. What is your advice there?
Well, now I'm going to take off my public policy hat, Todd, and now I'm going to put on my sex therapy hat, a hat that I've worn for 31 years proudly. I've done about 35,000 sessions of marriage counseling and sex therapy. And it's a lot of sessions. I've already worn out my first leather chair. I'm on my second one now. The advice that I have, and I'm going to say this in humanist terms because it's such a pleasure to be talking to an audience like this. The advice that I have is, let's treat sexuality the same as we treat everything else. Now, I don't know if you cook. You look like you eat, but I don't know if you cook. But imagine two people going into the kitchen and cooking a meal together. And imagine that, just for sake of argument,
they're making bacon?
Well, with a side order of butter, I know. Let's say, for sake of argument, that this couple did not have any words for any of the ingredients that they were going to use for this meal. And let's make it really interesting and say that this couple did not have any words for any of the objects that they were going to use while they were cooking. And now let's make it really interesting and say that this couple did not have any words for the activities that they were going to use during the cooking process. So they have no words for the ingredients, for the implements, or for the activities. Now go cook a meal. Here's what it would sound like. Honey, take some of that, it with that, over there. That's what it would sound like. Now, nobody cooks that way. People say, take that oregano over there. People say, take that cutting board over there. People say, saute that, but only for a couple of minutes because we don't want it to burn, because olive oil burns at a lower temperature than vegetable oil. That's how people cook. And you don't have to be a gourmet to know that if you're going to fry an egg, you need a little bit of oil, either in a spray can or in a bottle, right? You don't need to be a gourmet cook to know that if you're going to scramble an egg, you need a fork, not a spoon. Now, when it comes to sexuality, people need words for the objects involved. People need words for the processes that they're going to go through. People need words for, honey, a quarter of an inch to the left, please. People need those words. And people also need the comfort to use those words. So you can have the best frying pan in town, but if you don't feel comfortable saying, honey, pass me that frying pan, if you don't feel comfortable saying, oh, honey, that's a Teflon pan, you don't need all that oil, if you don't feel comfortable saying, honey, turn the temperature down on that thing, then the best frying pan in town doesn't do you any good. So what I say to couples is, you need the words. You need the words to be able to pursue the activities that you want to have. And you need to be able to say, I like my steak cooked medium rare, not well done. So, honey, ease up on the pressure a little bit because my clitoris is starting to get a little beat up there, So what I say to couples about pursuing sexual satisfaction or pleasure or closeness or gratification, however you want to put it, is treat sex like you treat everything else, assuming that you have a healthy relationship, assuming that you like the other person. And that would mean you talk about sex, you talk about your body, you talk about their body. If your feet are cold during sex, put socks on. People say, oh, that's so unsexy. I don't get that. A naked person who likes you wearing socks is just as sexy as a naked person who likes you not wearing socks. And by the way, socks is a lot sexier than cold feet, right? So. And that, people pay me good money. They say, Doc, we have this really important question we got to ask you, Doc. What do you do if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of sex? Now, I have never in my 31 years as a psychologist, I've never had anybody come in and pay me good money to say, Doc, what do you do if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of watching a movie? What do you do if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of eating lunch? What do you do if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of playing dominoes with your kids? Nobody asked me those questions, but people actually ask me, what do you do if you have to go to the bathroom in the middle of sex? So there's this exceptionalism around sexuality that's a heritage of Western culture. And without taking anything away from sex, without trivializing it, without minimizing it, we need to bring sex back into real life where everything else is. We need to bring sex back into real life where we live. And remember that we're bigger than sex rather than the other way around.
Todd, I thought you were going to ask about having open relationships. That's not what you're getting at, huh?
I was not actually going to ask about that, though that is an interesting topic.
Yeah.
Well, instead of asking about open relationships per se, we might want to ask, is there only one way for couples to have a decent sexual relationship? Or is there only one way for individuals to have a satisfying sexual relationship or experiences? And the answer, of course, is no. there are as many different relationship configurations as there are people. And there are as many different kinds of sexual experiences as there are people. And for some people, the sexiest thing in the world is to have somebody look at them and use their name. And for other people, the sexiest thing is to have 47 orgasms in a row. And you can't tell, you know, just by looking at somebody which of those two things they're going to prefer. Every couple has to invent sex anew for themselves at least once. And if they're together long enough, they have to invent sex over and over and over again. Sex is different when you're 23 and you have a strong back and strong knees than it is when you're 53, when the most important sexual organ at 53 becomes your lower back. When the most important aspect of oral sex is what's the angle of your neck? Because by 53, your neck hurts if you hold it at the wrong angle. So in my other new book, I have another new book out called Sexual Intelligence, What We Really Want from Sex and How to Get It. It's out from HarperCollins. It came out in February. One of the things that I talk about is that when we develop our ideas about sexuality, we typically say in young adulthood or adolescence, maybe we're 15 or 17, when we develop most of our ideas about what sexuality actually means, most of us have the body of a young and healthy person. We have a lot of flexibility. We can stay up late and get up the next morning without even a wrinkle. At some point, we don't have that body anymore. We don't have that body very long. I mean, both of you are young and healthy and good-looking, and if you're listening to this, you should imagine two really nice young people here, nicely dressed. And
keep talking, doctor.
You can be nicely dressed when you're 53, but by the time you're 53, you don't have that young, healthy, flexible body anymore. And so we need to change our vision of sexuality again and again and again, again and again and again. And people who don't realize that are stuck in a time warp, trying to have the sex at 47 that they had when they were 17. And life just isn't like that. And some people become so bitter about that or so self-critical about that they lose their sense of themselves as sexual beings. And that's a shame. And so one of the things as humanists that we want to do is we want to remind people, you have the option, you have the privilege as a human being to reinvent sex as many times as you want to, as many times as is necessary, as many times as you can think of. You have the opportunity, you have the privilege of reinventing sex.
What happens when the members of a couple reinvent sex differently? How do they resolve the conflicts there?
Well, you know, that's what keeps me in business. But of course, that's not unique to sex. I mean, what happens if two people get together when they're 20 and they both agree, we're going to live a real simple lifestyle. We're not going to acquire a lot of things. We're just going to live a simple, pleasant life. And one of them wakes up one morning and decides, I think it would be cool to maybe go to law school. And their partner says, yeah, sure, knock yourself out, go to law school, very nice. And the person graduates from law school, and he or she thinks it might be fun to be a public defender. Well, that's a nice job. But let's say they can't get a job as a public defender, or they get a job as a public defender and they don't like it. So then they manage to get a job in a high-end law firm. And 2 or 3 years into it, they're working 60, 70 hours a week. And their partner says, hey, wait, what happened to our simple lifestyle? So that's the same issue as a couple having differences in their interests in sexuality. Or for that matter, a couple gets together, they both agree, let's have two kids. One kid into the relationship, one of the partners says, I have enough kids. The other one says, no, I want three. Now, of course, my professional advice is you should never have more children than hands. But putting that aside for a second, every couple, if they're going to stay together over the long haul, and of course, not everybody needs to do that. It's not the only way of living. But if couples are going to be together over the long haul, they are continually going to investigate and explore and discover, what does it mean for us to be this couple? And if people are creative and flexible and they can communicate well and they like each other, they will have the opportunity to explore lots of worlds, some of which they didn't anticipate, some of which they didn't think they were actually going to like, but they're willing to at least check it out. When couples are rigid, when one or the other member of a couple is rigid, or when couples believe there's only one right way to be a couple, oh, they're in for a world of pain, because life is not going to let you be rigid. Life is not going to let you stay stuck. The next challenge is already on its way to your house. So to go back to your question, Todd, what do you do when members of a couple have different interests? They do what they have to do, what couples do in every other arena, which is to talk about it and to sincerely try and understand what is it that the other person wants. Because a lot of people, what they think of as communication is, let me tell you even better what I think. And what people really need to understand about communication is that it's not about telling the other person what you think. First, it's you understanding what the other person thinks. Because when you have two people in a couple and each person says, no, 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 you need to understand me better. And the other person says, no, 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 you need to understand me better. Well, you can see where that goes. That's how people end up in my office. So what communication needs is, where it starts is, please explain to me even better what you mean, what you want, what you have in mind, what you're feeling, what you're upset about, and keep talking until you feel like I get it. Not until I feel like I get it, until you feel like you get it. And when you feel like I really understand what's on your mind, you are magically going to feel a lot more interested in what I have on my mind. And that's as applicable to sex as it is to anything else.
Now, before a couple gets to the point of reinventing sex for themselves, there's something that we refer to in the gay community, in particular with lesbian couples, as lesbian bed death. So is that a myth? Is that real?
Well, I think what's true is that there's people bed death. I mean, there are lots and lots and lots and lots of couples where they get together and they're best friends and they don't have sex, where they have sex at the beginning and then the sex goes away, or people let it slip away. There are a lot of theories about why lesbians are particularly vulnerable to this. But I think the truth is that couples in general are vulnerable to this, and maybe lesbians talk about it more, or maybe lesbians have higher expectations. I think partly it's a matter of expectations, because when heterosexual people are growing up, they figure, well, of course, I'll have some sort of sexual relationship or relationships, and life goes on. But I think for a lot of lesbians who grow up either conflicted about their orientation, or they're in the closet, they're hiding, they don't know, am I ever going to find somebody like me? They see all these images of non-lesbian sex all around, and they feel left out. And then when they finally connect with somebody, I think some lesbians, at least, I think, oh, finally, now I can have the relationship of my dreams. Oh, great. Well, it doesn't work like that. And it doesn't work like that not just for lesbians. It doesn't necessarily work like that for anybody else. There is another idea that lesbians are women, and that in our culture, women learn not to be too pushy about sex. Whether you're gay or straight, women do learn not to be too pushy about sex. You get two of those together, and you have two people who are not being too pushy about sex. So I think that's part of the whole lesbian bed death thing.
Can you tell our listeners a little bit about kind of a separate subject, but something that's been very hot in humanist and atheist online communities lately, which is the topic of sexual harassment, particularly at conferences? And so, first of all, can you tell our listeners what your experience is and what your expertise is in this area?
Well, that's a really important thing. And let's name this part of the conversation what I think it needs to be named. This is not a conversation about sexual harassment. This needs to be a conversation about unwanted sexual attention. So let's start with the right terminology. There is an issue whenever you get more than one person in a room. There's always the possibility of somebody experiencing unwanted sexual attention. And it may be that sexual attention is headed their way and it's unwanted, or it may be that attention is headed their way and they experience it, or they perceive it as sexual and they don't want it. And it may be that They want attention, but suddenly it turns sexual. Or it may be that a person thinks that somebody's unwanted sexual attention is in some way dangerous or insulting. So let's start by calling it what I think we're really talking about, which is unwanted sexual attention. Whenever you get two or more people together, that's a possibility. And the question is, so what about it? So what about it? And some people feel that it's a problem that's unique to women. I don't think it is. Some people think that it's unique to young or attractive women or men. It's not. And some people think it's unique to sex, and it's not. I can tell you that everybody who goes to a conference has the experience of being buttonholed by somebody at a cocktail party, and they just can't get away. And whether the conversation's about Alabama or, you know, you have the loveliest breasts I've ever seen in my life, you know, unwanted attention is unwanted attention. As long as it's not dangerous, unwanted attention is unpleasant, no matter what the venue. Now, we live in a sex-negative culture. We live in a culture where there's sexual violence. We live in a culture where there's anxiety about sexuality. And so when the content of unwanted attention is sexual, some people get nervous. And I'm very sympathetic about that. I'm very, very sympathetic about people who feel vulnerable to other people. I'm very sympathetic to people who feel vulnerable because they're trapped in an elevator or because they're someplace where they just want to be left alone. I'm very sympathetic about that. I happen to be kind of a shy person myself. I'm very sympathetic about people who feel vulnerable. Now, let's get to sexual harassment. There was a time when there was no sexual harassment legal doctrine. There was a time when in hierarchical structures, hierarchical organizations or institutions, people at the top actually felt that they deserved to have access to other people sexually who were underneath them, so to speak. And that was a terrible thing. It still goes on in a lot of parts of the world. In China, for example, there are a lot of places where if you're at the top of the pecking order, one of your perks is you get access to the sexuality of the people below you. This is a terrible, 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 terrible thing. Let's all agree this is a terrible, terrible thing. There's a difference between the expectation that somebody has a right to have the access to you sexually on the one hand, and you just being uncomfortable or them making you uncomfortable because they're clumsy, because they're awkward, because they've been drinking, because they're used to getting their way, because they're big and you're small. There's a big difference. There's a big difference. And it's unfortunate. It's unfortunate when some people confuse, well, gee whiz, you're clumsy and I'm uncomfortable with, you have just committed a crime. You have just violated organizational doctrine. You have just violated me personally. There's a big difference. And I'm terribly sad to hear that there are some people who are misinterpreting what's going on at humanist functions. That, yeah, of course, occasionally person A says to person B, gee, honey, you look attractive. What do you say? Person B needs to learn how to say no thank you and turn around and walk away, or no thank you. Where'd you get those shoes? It's unfortunate that some people are actually believing that the humanist movement actually condones any sort of sexual pressure. No. What goes on at humanist meetings is the same thing that goes on everywhere else, which is, hey, I'm clumsy. You're attractive. What do you say? No? Oh, gee, that's too bad. Oh, what about that person on the other side of the room? Think I'll go over there. That goes on everywhere. There's absolutely no place that's safer that I've observed than a humanist meeting, and I've been to a lot of different meetings.
So do you think that because as human beings we're inherently sexual, that there's no place where this kind of unwanted sexual attention isn't inappropriate?
I think that in every social situation, there's a continuum of behavior that's appropriate. I mean, when you go to a humanist meeting, it's not appropriate to pick your nose in public. When you go to a humanist meeting, it's not appropriate to show up without your trousers. When you go to a humanist meeting, it's not appropriate to speak really loudly when somebody else is in front of the podium talking. When you're at a humanist meeting, it's not appropriate to walk up to somebody and say, that is the ugliest nose I ever saw. Why don't you do something about that? there's a lot of things that are inappropriate at a humanist meeting and not appropriate at any other meeting. And coming on to people sexually who you should have known wouldn't be interested, that's a skill that most people acquire as they go through life. Some people don't acquire it, or some people acquire it, but then they lose it after a couple of drinks. Or some people acquire it, and then they lose it when they're just blinded by someone who is uniquely attractive to them, either because of their face or their clothes or their age or the book they're carrying under their arm. So, of course, there are lots of places where it's not appropriate to come on to someone sexually, but there's lots of places where it's not appropriate to do a lot of things. And you know, some people are clumsier than others. And in every crowd, you get some moron who just doesn't pick up social cues, whether it's the social cue of how to dress, the social cue of don't you own a toothbrush, the social cue of why on earth would you think I was interested in you sexually? And, you know, just like, you know, every family has one person in the family who's not as bright as the others. Every association has people coming to the meeting who just don't pick up on social cues. The idea that young women or older women or anybody needs to be specially protected from clumsy people who don't pick up social cues, that's a huge step backwards. We, of all people in the humanist movement, we should be the last people who want to patronize women and say, oh my God, you need special protection from clumsy men. Oh my God, you need special protection from feeling uncomfortable or disappointed. You know, I'm old enough to remember when women were thought to need protection from a lot of things. Women don't need special protection from anything that I don't need special protection from. If I'm 5'1" and some, you know, 240-pound human being wants to get on top of me, I might need protection from that, not because I'm a man or a woman, but because I'm small and they're big. That doesn't go on at humanist meetings. You don't see people jump on top of each other.
At what point does unwanted sexual attention get to a point where conference organizers should actually step in and have policies and do something about it?
That's a wonderful question. That's a wonderful question. And we have now decades of case law and decades of organizations struggling with this question. In a democracy, you may recall that we believe that it's better to let 10 guilty people go free than for one person to be unfairly, unjustly convicted and incarcerated. I think that you cannot possibly have a group of people get together without somebody being uncomfortable about something. I'm not willing to say that being uncomfortable about sexuality is worse than anything else. I'm perfectly willing to say that coercion is worse than non-coercion, whatever the topic. And I'm perfectly willing to say that clumsy people make other people uncomfortable, even if those other people are clumsy too. But we cannot have a meeting of 300 people or 400 people where there's a spirited exchange of ideas and, frankly, a spirited exchange of personalities. You can't get 300 people together in a room without somebody walking away being uncomfortable, somebody inadvertently making a remark that a Jewish person is going to feel insulted by. Or, I mean, I talk about pornography a lot, and people walk away from me shaking their heads at meetings sometimes, thinking that I have my head up my butt. So, and of course, I feel disappointed about that. But look, if you want to go to a meeting and you want to talk about your ideas, you have to be willing to have people shake their heads and walk away from you and think you have your head up your butt. If you believe that gay people have the right to be married the same as straight people, you have the right to say that. And you have the right to be disappointed when somebody thinks that you're a moron for thinking that. So you can't possibly have a meeting of 300 or 400 people of men and women, young and old, tall and short, blue and green. You can't possibly have a meeting of 300 or 400 people, whether they're the same gender or different genders, without somebody feeling unwanted sexual attention. It can't be done. And it shouldn't be done. It should not be done. We should not try and create an environment that is so constricted that nobody is going to feel free to actually ask a question where they don't know the answer. That's what unwanted sexual attention is. It's somebody asking a question when they don't know what the answer is going to be. And if you try and structure a meeting where nobody is going to ask any questions, where they don't know what the answer is going to be, you don't need a humanist movement. You can't have a humanist movement under those circumstances. Sexual harassment policy, the legal doctrine of sexual harassment, is absolutely essential in modern life. And what it says is essentially that people should not use sexuality as a weapon to block other people's careers or other people's physical safety. People should not have the opportunity to use sexuality as a weapon to prevent other people from being fully actualized. That's what the humanist movement is about. Finding more and more and more ways to help people become fully actualized. And part of the process of becoming fully actualized is interacting with a lot of people, some of whom believe very different things than you do. Part of the process of becoming fully actualized is acquiring the emotional skills and the communication skills to deal with a wide range of people. Inevitably, that's going to include unwanted attention, and inevitably, that may include unwanted sexual attention. And what we need to be doing in the movement here is guaranteeing that at large functions or small, people feel they have the right to say no thank you. That's the policy we need, that everybody has a right to say no thank you, and that everybody should be encouraged to listen to the people that they're talking to. That's what we need, more listening, you know, that when someone says no thank you, someone hears no thank you. So if you want to craft a policy, we can certainly craft a policy of no means no, using any sort of legal machinery or organizational machinery to help people grow up is a mistake. Using organizational machinery in the attempt to protect people from feeling uncomfortable is a bad mistake. I mean, that's as strongly as I can put it. It's not just, oh, that's not a problem. I mean, here's the problem. The problem is using legal or organizational machinery in the misguided attempt to protect people from feeling uncomfortable. So what kind of a policy do we need? We need a policy that says we will not put up for one second with any kind of physical pressure or physical coercion. We need a policy that people need to be responsible for their behavior, including their drinking, and that there's always somebody available in the organization if anyone feels mistreated, if anyone feels like their ability to function at a meeting is being blocked. We obviously need people that you can go to. And if you are experiencing pressure that you don't like more than once and no thank you isn't working, that there's somebody in the organization that you can go to and say, you see that guy over there? You know, this is the third cocktail party in a row where that guy was, you know, telling me what a great lover he is. Would you please tell him to back off? That's all we need. That's all we need. I'm not aware of any documented instances, you know, of sexual violence at humanist meetings. If there is, I'll be at the front of the line to say that's not okay. Short of that, I think people need to learn to say, you know, that feels like crap when you say that. Stop it. If you can't do that, you are not going to be a very effective humanist out in the world.
Dr. Klein, can you tell our listeners where they can learn more about you?
MartyKlein.com, MartyKlein, MartyKlein.com is my website. You can also get there by sexed.org. I love my URL, sexed.org.
That is a good one.
I publish a monthly electronic newsletter called Sexual Intelligence, and it's got a few articles about sexuality every month. It's pretty nice. And we never trade or sell your email address. So, Todd, if you subscribe, actually, I know you already do, but we can tell our listeners if they subscribe and then the next day they get spam, you know, offering to make their penis bigger, it doesn't come from me, okay? And I know that you know my book, America's War on Sex. I'm very proud of my book, this book. It's my sixth or seventh book. And in it, I talk about how the religious right is meticulously using the issue of sexual regulation to undermine secular democracy. And don't let the footnotes scare you off, folks. It's also got some fun stories in there. One of the interesting stories in there is about how the city of Phoenix destroyed the swing club community there. That's an interesting story. I actually flew to Phoenix and talked to everybody involved there, a very vibrant swinger community that the city completely dismantled. And I talk about sex education. I talk about the premarital sex zone. And so if people want to know more about me, just go to sexed.org and you can see my blog, you can see some of my articles. And you can also come to a humanist conference. That's the best way to get to know me. Come to a humanist conference, hear me speak, and then we can go to a cocktail party and have a little chit-chat.
Thanks so much, Marty.
Would it be okay just if I was to touch you while you're lying on my table on your back? See, I like it when a girl makes it easy. So when you bear arms, you won't have my attack. Trust me, as I'm positioning credentials after all. Now it's not pretty for a girl that is so angry, and Maya's such a pretty little girl.
That was Dr. Marty Klein. You can learn more about him at martyklein.com. You can subscribe to his blog, Sexual Intelligence. You can book him to speak at your conference or your group, and you can buy his books.
Yeah, it was an interesting it was definitely an interesting experience. And actually, this interview predated a post he put online about harassment and some of the positions there, which was an interesting post, had a little bit of backlash on it because I think he created a composite of several different cases, some from within the movement and some from outside. And he did not post that initially in the post, which some people felt like he was really confusing the facts of some of the stories. And he may have been. that's possible. I don't know what research he did on the various pieces. So just for our listeners who've seen that post and any criticisms or comments on the post, this interview was a few days before that.
And speaking of posts with lots of comments and backlash, Todd.
Yes.
You have some firsthand experience with that, don't you? I read your post on Pathos this morning on Hemant Mehta's blog, The Friendly Atheist.
Yeah, it's interesting to see some of the reactions. There's been quite a number of people who have been very supportive of what I've said. And there's been some people who've been very snarky and some significant ad hominem attacks and people who haven't even commented on what I said, but rather just be like, well, he's a dude and he's rich, so he can't understand. It's right. Like, okay, maybe. Thank you for being a sexist and devaluing my opinion. Appreciate it. Let's move on.
Yeah. I mean, thank you for writing it just because, like, it's important to continue the dialogue because nothing's ever going to happen if we don't talk about it.
Exactly. Exactly. So it's important to have the dialogue. It's important to refine these policies. It's, you know, one of the examples I gave is that a simple handshake without asking permission is a technical violation of some of these policies. Now, I'll admit that's a stupid example, but it was supposed to be a stupid example. If a stupid example breaches the policy needs to be evaluated.
Well, and I think the bottom line is people need to feel safe. Like people just need to have we need a common understanding. And what I think that you're saying is that the policy is that time to do it. That's the place that we create that common understanding. And maybe people need to be trained on like, these are situations that can be perceived this way. These are situations that can be perceived this way. And like, maybe we need to not assume that everyone has the same understanding and the same knowledge and the same social cues and the same social intelligence, because that's not the case.
Exactly. I mean, I spent a long time in a family business and was being trained essentially to someday run a company with around 4,000 employees. And I was part of the loops that that approved and reviewed and revised our employee handbooks, which included harassment policies. And I've personally seen HR examples of real harassment, like real people using their position of power to try to get sex. And that's disgusting. Now, that in our case, we remedied it, and I won't name any names, but I've seen these kind of things before, and that's part of the reason it's so important to have these protections in place. They really do happen. But on the flip side of things, I've also seen HR issues where people have just made stuff up or just gone completely, you know, made very wild or false or exaggerated claims that when looked at carefully turned out to just be someone with an axe to grind. You have to protect the accused and you have to protect the victim. And until you know what the details are, you got to make sure you're as fair as possible.
Listeners, what do you think?
You can call us and comment on our listener comment line, which is 202-618-1371. And while you're at it, you can also check us out at thehumanisthour.org for previous episodes and show notes. And you can see the whole show on pathios.com/blog/thehumanisthour.
And of course, we have the show notes page for this episode where you can learn more about Marty Klein. You can feel free to leave a comment down at the bottom there. But you can also like us on Facebook. You can subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or just using any other RSS reader. You can also find the link to Todd's guest blog on Hemant Mehta's Friendly Atheist blog. And tune in for the following shows because we're going to have more content from AHA's conference. We've got, of course, our Humanist of the Year, Gloria Steinem. We've got a pretty cool interview with Cenk Uygur from the Young Turks. We've got a panel that we did, Todd and I recorded live. We interviewed 5 authors and lots more great stuff. So definitely stay tuned. And until then, thanks for listening to The Humanist Hour. I'm Jess Constantine.
And I'm Todd Stiefel.
Your guilt and own your sin. And in my dreams, I'm not afraid to kick your teeth in.